You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Happy holidays to you.
We got the 829 Noble. Okay, perfect.
This guy?
With netting.
Yeah.
And then I was wondering if I could also get garland.
Yeah.
We're at a Christmas tree farm in the rural community of Somis, just north of Camarillo in Ventura County.
Perfect. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. You have a Merry Christmas.
You too.
Thank you.
This is Hagel Tree Farm.
My name's Ethan Hagel, second generation Christmas tree grower. My dad, John Hagel, he started this operation back in 1992, the year I was born, and we're still going strong.
Early December is prime time for the Christmas tree business, whether you're looking for one of Hagel's homegrown pines, or browsing their rows of fir trees shipped in from Oregon, or maybe going the fake tree route with a manufactured pre-lit tannenbaum from a home goods store. But this year, you're either going to have to dig deeper into your pocket to afford one, or maybe cut back and settle for a tree that doesn't quite reach the ceiling. Today on Greater LA, KCRW's Kaylee Wells tells us why.
This is one of the few places left that Angelenos can cut down their own Christmas tree, choosing from 11 acres of Monterey pines growing in neat rows. When he was a kid, Hagel could name several other tree farms within a few miles of here. Now,
I don't know of another spot close by anymore. I think most of them have closed down.
Hagel says his family used to sell a lot more of their homegrown trees than the imported ones, which are the traditional-looking fir trees stacked in a tent at the front of the property that get shipped in from the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, yeah. It used to be probably 4-1. We would sell 4 of our trees to 1 import. And, you know, that's when we had a large crop with 10-foot-tall trees that you cut down yourself.
But this year, there aren't any homegrown 10-foot-tall trees. That's because the sad pandemic Christmas of 2020 was good for his business, and extra hordes of people cut down mid-sized trees last year that would have been the big trees this year.
You know, I'm in the business of making people happy, so I'll tell them, yeah, go ahead, go cut it down. Well, after a few hundred of those, next year rolls around, and you're stuck with a bunch of 6-foot trees with no outliers.
This month, I can see clear across all of Hagel's crop of trees without standing on my tiptoes. And I'm not tall. There are still customers wandering into the field with a wheelbarrow and a saw and bright-eyed kids in tow. But they frequently come back empty-handed, or they splurge for one of the imported trees.
Well, we've been coming here for probably 10 years to get our Christmas tree and cut our own tree.
Linda Thomas drove down from Ojai, 35 miles away. She started coming here after the U-Pick tree farms closer to her shut down. But this time, she had to U-Pick from the trees imported from Oregon and Washington.
It's part of a tradition that we have in our family, and I just enjoy it. But we couldn't find one this year. We got one of the ones, the super deluxe ones that are all even and perfect and whatnot. What's out there is what's left over there, and that is just, they're too small. They're really just not much of a tree this year.
In fact, most customers now are buying the Oregon trees because they're taller. And if you're going to do that, get ready to pay.
As time goes on, labor goes up, the shipping and the product itself, especially this year, everything's kind of gone up maybe anywhere between 10 to 20%. The county water is just going up and up and up. The well, there's just not a lot of groundwater. It just doesn't produce a lot.
Corin Glover of Los Feliz says at over $200, she spent more on a tree this year than she ever has before. But she understands why the price is going up.
We cut our own for many, many years. But, you know, as the weather conditions and the limited trees have gotten harder, it's harder now for the tree growers.
She comes here every year, but she started settling for the pre-cut tree about 4 years ago.
Because they just didn't have the same selection. I mean, years ago, this used to just be fields of trees that you could, you know, walk the aisles and pick your tree and cut it down.
So you might think this is a good time to make the switch from a natural tree to a manufactured one. But that's not exactly cheap this year either. Just head back down the 101 and ask small business owner Brian Gold, who runs Aldic Home in Van Nuys.
To the average customer, it looks fairly similar in the store. to us, and especially our merchandise manager and our buying team, it looks incomplete. We don't have all of the styles that we wanted, certain looks that we wanted to do.
Gold's grandfather founded this place in the 50s. For most of the year, it's a home decor store. Gold boasts that starting in August, they put out one of the best Christmas displays in the country. A full fake holiday town in the back of the store, a rainbow tunnel of Christmas lights, a stunning array of gigantic fake trees adorned in glass balls and ornate ribbon. Now here it is December already, and they are way behind.
Normally we would have had everything in by now, but there's new things coming in every week. New shipments, 8 pallets of ornaments here, 5 pallets there, and all that gets priced and thrown out on the floor as quickly as possible.
Their display includes an entire Christmas tree lot filled with manufactured trees.
These trees, we had to have these samples air freighted to us from the factory just so we could show them. The rest are out in the harbor.
Yes, that harbor. The trees are on one of those ships parked off our coast, tied up in the infamous traffic jam at the ports of LA and Long Beach. And the cost to get them to this side of the Pacific from Asian manufacturers? Get ready.
Shipping containers used to cost us about $3,000 to import, and we import about 10 container loads of Christmas trees and wreaths and garlands. This year, we got a deal, and it was about $18,000, $19,000 a container.
Yeah, you heard that right. It's 6 times more expensive for a shipping container that isn't even getting off the boat. And what's normally a 2.5-week trip across the Pacific is taking up to 2 months. And Christmas trees aren't exactly a popular purchase in January. So this isn't a cheaper year for the fake trees either. Customers like Pat Ramsey have noticed the displays look different.
It's a little bit less dramatic. I think they probably have less stock.
Ramsey owns the restaurant Centauri in Toluca Lake. He's going home with a green tree with fake snow on it. It's not exactly what he wanted.
Before, we had an all-white tree, but they don't really have all-white trees. This year, they have a couple, but not very many. So we had to kind of switch gears and to go to something that's more difficult.
He's shopping for his tree several weeks earlier than he normally does, knowing there'd be a supply shortage. Gold says that's been a trend in 2021.
This year's been the added factor of customers not thinking that there's going to be trees left over for them if they decide to get an artificial tree. So they've been coming in earlier than usual, certainly. October was our best year for Christmas trees.
The good news is Aldick Home is just 40 miles from the ports. So when supplies do get off the ships, they arrive the next day. And if a tree arrives too late, Gold can just sell it next year. As for Christmas tree farmer Ethan Hagel, he says even as the price to grow or ship in a tree goes up, his family's farm in Ventura County is not going anywhere. His grandfather owns the land, so they're safe from rent spikes, and the customers will keep coming.
You know, you can go get a tree off a lot anywhere in the United States, but there's not a lot, especially around here, there's not a lot of places to go cut your own. So, you know, whether they're coming from 3 hours away or 3 minutes up the road.
Short trees grow, and the 10-footers will be back next year. Meanwhile, as we've all learned to do during the pandemic, this might be a good year to downsize your expectations. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Most folks admire Santa Cruz Island off the coast of Ventura as a long, beautiful strip of pristine land on the horizon from afar. Visitors physically head there to sail and camp, hike, sea kayak. But New Yorker journalist and podcast host Dana Goodyear explores a dark moment on the island's past.
On the north side of the island, a couple hundred feet into the ocean, there's a huge white spattered rock with a sheer cliff face. It's called Bird Rock, for obvious reasons. Bird Rock has its own sea cave, a tall chamber with walls that are covered in green algae. It's mysterious and cool, but once you know the story of Fred Raylor, it's impossible to look at the sea cave, or any part of this beautiful island, the same way again.
And so Goodyear kicks off the second season of her podcast, Lost Hills, which tells the story of a mother and a son who drowned off Santa Cruz Island in January of 1981. The husband, Fred Raylor, was the sole survivor and only witness. Now, initially, the deaths were ruled accidental, but speculation among neighbors in Malibu changed everything.
My theory is that he rowed the boat into this cave with the intention of killing both of them.
Well, it looked to me like the kind of case where a person was convicted based on bias.
We're going to dig into it now. Dana Goodyear is here to talk about this season and the twists and turns. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
Before we talk about the crime itself, tell us a little bit about the Raylor family. Who were they and where did they live?
So the Raylors were this just absolutely perfect family. Someone described them to me as sort of the Christmas card family. And they were a blended Brady Bunch style family where both Fred and Verna had been married before and each had two kids from their first marriages, both of which had ended tragically. But they brought their family together and they were just this kind of happy, healthy. They played a lot of sports. They lived right on Sea Level Drive, which is down. It's an offshoot of Broad Beach Road. It's right on Lachuza Beach. It's just a spectacular setting. You can't imagine it. Now it's a place where only really, you know, multimillionaires and billionaires can afford to own property. But this moment where this story takes place in the late 70s and early 80s, it was really the last time that a middle-class family could live that way in Malibu. And that was part of my fascination with the story.
Yeah, all this is going on in Malibu. And again, you mentioned it several times in the pod about, you know, you can't live like this on a middle income anymore, certainly not on the not on the Pacific Coast. Tell us a little bit about that day on Santa Cruz Island. They were taking a trip, right?
Yeah, so it was January 2nd, 1981. It was the first Friday of the year, sort of a holiday weekend. And the Raylors actually, although he was a government employee and she was a teacher's aide, they owned this beautiful 50-foot sailboat called Perseverance. So they set out for Santa Cruz Island, which is one of the Channel Islands, and they had aboard, it was all four of the kids. It was Verna and Fred. It was Fred's parents who were visiting from the Midwest and one of his brothers and his brother's wife also visiting from the Midwest. So it was a big group. And also they had their six-month-old beagle puppy called Lady, who factors into the story in a pretty interesting way. And they all set out for the islands. And when they got there, sort of around lunchtime, the group split up. And Fred, Verna, and Doug, who was Verna's 8-year-old son from her first marriage, went out in a dory, which is sort of like a rowboat, with Lady the dog to supposedly, according to Fred, to take a picture. And what happened next, what Fred says happened next, is that Lady the dog lunged for some birds, and in an attempt to save Lady from going overboard, the dory flipped. And when he emerged from underneath, he saw Verna and Doug, and they were already in very rough shape, having lost consciousness, maybe throwing up. He tried to give them CPR, and ultimately they drowned and he was rescued.
But an investigation shows that perhaps it wasn't an accident, and Fred is now a suspect, right, in the deaths of his wife and stepson.
Yeah, what was really interesting is that autopsies were performed on Verna and Doug the day after their deaths, and they were determined to be, the finding was that these were accidental drownings. Now, Fred, as the next of kin, made funeral arrangements and prepared to have them cremated. Their bodies were already at that point transferred down to a mortuary in Los Angeles, and the cremations were about to take place when somebody that knew Fred from Malibu called up the Santa Barbara Sheriff's Department, Santa Barbara Sheriff's Department, because Santa Cruz Island is actually part of Santa Barbara County, and said, you know, you can't let these cremations go forward. You have to investigate Fred. You have to find out how his first wife died. Not only did Verna and Doug drown, his first wife, Jean, drowned in 1976 in the family pool. And once again, Fred was the only witness. So that tip from somebody in Malibu who knew the family was actually what set the investigation of Fred in motion.
Let's underscore, and, you know, with like five lines, that Fred Raylor has not been convicted in the death of his first wife, correct?
Yeah. So there was never, at the time of Jean Raylor's death, there was no real investigation. It was determined to be an accident at the time. Fred was only convicted of having murdered Verna and Doug, and he has been in prison for 40 years for the murders of Verna and Doug.
He's serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole. You say in the podcast he has reached out to you. He called you most mornings while you were reporting this story. Does he think that this podcast could exonerate him, change his conviction?
I think that's the hope of the family, for sure. I also think is pretty compelling is that legal experts tend to agree with them that the case wasn't made at trial, that it's possible that, you know, whether or not he's guilty, that legally he shouldn't have been convicted based on the evidence that was presented.
There are three episodes out so far, so we're not sure how the podcast will end. Only you know that, Dana Goodyear. Do you have a take at the end of all of this? I mean, you don't need to disclose. Obviously, no spoiler alert, but have you come to your own conclusions?
I have come to my own conclusions. It's complicated, too, because both in the case of Jean's death and in the case of Verna and Doug's death, Fred Raylor is the only witness. So ultimately, it comes down to how persuasive his story is. And when you balance that against everything else that you can find out about what happened and what the circumstances were. So yes, I have come to a conclusion or a belief, and obviously the criminal justice system came to a conclusion, but those things aren't perfectly aligned, I guess I'll put it that way.
Your podcast, Dana, investigates, you know, the dark side of Malibu. Season one focused on this series of strange shootings. I remember this at Malibu Creek State Park. So why Malibu? Does this area particularly have a lot of mysteries? I mean, what attracts you to reporting on Malibu?
I think it's a really interesting place because its surface tells you one story, and it tells that story pretty insistently, which is this is beautiful, rich, young people having fun in the sun. And the minute you scratch the surface, you find out there is so much else going on there. And there's so much complexity and quite a lot of darkness and so much denial of that because of the importance of that surface image. So it seems to me like a really rich place for storytelling. So I'm digging in and continuing to dig in.
I guess we're going to have to listen, right, to find out. Dana Goodyear, the host of the podcast Lost Hills. The first couple of episodes of the second season are out now. Dana, thanks for your time. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, onward now with Greater LA, and let's head to the County of Orange. A hazing ritual over at Mater Dei High School back in February left a young football player with a traumatic brain injury and a broken nose. And last month, the family of that player filed a lawsuit against the school and against the Roman Catholic Diocese of Orange. Gustavo Arellano writes for the LA Times. He's here with KCRW's Orange County line to tell us more. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So tell us what you know about this hazing ritual called Bodies, is that right, at Mater Dei High?
Yeah, so Bodies is apparently, I'm not a football player, never was, but This was a hazing ritual that had apparently been going on for years, where football players, the players on the team, they would face off against each other. And so they would hit, like punch each other, basically. But you couldn't hit below the belt and you couldn't hit above the neck. So hence you hit each other in your torso, on your back or whatnot. And you would go on until, I guess, someone cried uncle. And then, all right, cool, you're part of the team. You're a brother. Let's go beat up some other people on the football field.
All right, not above the neck, not below the belt, but this guy whose family is suing had traumatic brain injury and a broken nose. That's above the neck.
So I saw the video. It is not pretty to see. So player one, let's say player one is the one who's doing the punching. Player two is the one who is filing the lawsuit. So you see player one, who's 50 pounds heavier than player two, go at him. They're, you know, swinging. It's in the locker room. Player two swings and misses. Player one throws him down to the ground and hits him with a right on the head, then hits him a second time with the left. And as player two's holding himself at this point, you could see like a laceration, a bloody laceration on his eye. Then you see a sucker punch at that point. And then even at that point, the players who are seeing this, the people who are looking at this in the modern day locker room, they're saying, chill, chill, chill. And you could tell, you know, during fights, when there's a fight, people usually circle around and they're hooting and hollering. There's kids looking at their iPhones. They're like so nonchalant. So this is completely something that goes on. And so it's nothing that draws anyone's attention until you hear that third sucker punch.
What do we know about how the injured player is doing? I mean, he transferred out of modern day, right?
Yeah, so the father talked to my colleague Bill Plaschke on the LA Times, and he said, look, he still has this injury. He transferred to another school. He's participating in sports. So a lot of people are saying, well, you can't be that injured if you're still playing football. You can't be that traumatized. But that's not the point. I mean, according to the lawsuit, the father went to the coach, Bruce Rollinson, a legend in prep sports. And Bruce Rollinson laughed about the whole thing, allegedly saying, oh, if I had $100 for every time that my players did bodies, I'd be a millionaire or something like that. Huh. They tried to talk to the principal, Francis Clare, at Modern Day, never heard anything back. Basically, Modern Day, both the football program and the school just gave a big shrug to the young man's, his son's injuries, which again was a broken nose, the lacerations you see, and the traumatic brain injury.
Let's hear from Modern Day coach Bruce Rollison, who was on Channel 2 Sports Central with Jim Hill just about a week ago after they won, and he just flat out deflected. Let's listen.
You know what, Jim? I'm not going to talk about that, obviously. Let's talk about the athletes and what we accomplished last night and what we've been through to get here with COVID and the spring season. That's the most important thing, and I don't have a comment about the other stuff.
That's the most important thing, right?
Oh.
Has anyone at the school taken accountability, whether that be the football coach or coaches? The administration.
Of course not. This is Modern Day. I mean, so my column focused on, if you think there's going to be anything happening with this student who got his nose broken, this is a school that has had to settle through the Diocese of Orange multiple sex abuse cases over the past 20 years. This is where, like, the school administrators knew that people were having, sexually molesting students and allowing people to quietly resign, making jokes about it. This is a school that, one of its principals, Michael Harris, has been the subject of numerous sex abuse claims. Now, noted, he has never had any criminal charges against him, but he alone has had sex abuse cases totaling more than $7 million. This is a school and a diocese that has actively covered up for pedophiles who they employ. So to think they're going to do anything about their football program, not in a million years. That's why Coach Rollison, who, by the way, of course, can't talk about it because there's a lawsuit, but it's very telling how he calls it that stuff. Really? So one of your former players getting a broken nose by another player of yours or former players, you're just going to call it that stuff? That's just crass.
We're short on time, just seconds here, Gustavo, but the district attorney, Todd Spitzer, says the ritual does not meet legal standards for criminal hazing or felony assault. Why is that?
He says it was mutual, which is preposterous. I mean, I would ask Todd, and, Todd listens to this. So what about Kim Pham, Todd Spitzer? Was that also mutual? Because that wasn't the case when it happened there. That was another case where involved two people fighting each other.
All right, keep us updated, please. Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, and of course, our Orange County aficionado. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
That's going to do it for us this evening. Tomorrow, from Christmas tree woes to new car woes, dealers are scrambling with shortages of new cars at a popular time for buying. And what could California look like without snow in the Sierra Nevada mountain range? There are serious ramifications for sure. You're going to hear that tomorrow on the next new episode of GLA. We, however, are online anytime at kcrw.com/GLA. Subscribe to the Greater LA podcast, kcrw.com/GLA. Tell us how you're doing. Tell us how we're doing. And, of course, you can subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sedley, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all helped put today's episode together. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thank you for your time and your ears this evening. Have a great night.